Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Lord Leverholm, the great philanthropic industrialist. And as always, my co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, well, this week we have a new Greatest Briton, and this one was suggested to us by Michael Woodbridge. And you will find an Albion Insights interview with Michael Woodbridge. He's at RadioAlbion.com. He's a long-time nationalist, a veteran nationalist, I guess you could say. And there's a very interesting interview with him when he was in prison behind the Iron Curtain, which makes for good listening. And he suggested that we do this character as one of our Greatest Britons, and he's provided me with a couple of books on the man himself, and I've also taken some notes from Wikipedia. And the Greatest Briton for this week is Lord Leverholm, William Hesketh Lever, 1st Viscount Leverholm, of Unilever fame, the big corporation that is now called Unilever. Originally, that was started off by him. He was born 19th of September 1851, and he died the 7th of May 1925. He was an English industrialist, a great philanthropist, as we will hear, and a politician. Having been educated at a small private school until the age of 9, then at church schools until he was 15, which is a somewhat privileged education for that time, he then started work at his father's wholesale grocery business in Bolton. And I'll just stop there, because from my notes from this book, I found something quite interesting about being a greengrocer. It was quite an important trade at the time, and you had apprentices. And if you were an apprentice in 1823, you got food and lodging and medicine, and that was it. You got no wages, and the apprenticeship would last 2 or 3 years, and it was expected that your family or your friends would help you out with everything else. And then once you were a grocer, you could expect to earn quite a bit of money. This is one grocer in 1851. This is actually Lord Leverholm's father in 1851. In his household, there was the husband, the wife, 5 daughters, a journeyman grocer, 2 apprentice grocers, and 3 servants, a cook, a housemaid, and a nurse. So one greengrocer could expect to pay for a journeyman grocer, 2 apprentice grocers, and have 3 servants for his 5 daughters. And you compare that to what a shopkeeper earns today. Nowhere near that. So I guess the economy must have been doing a lot better back then than it is today. Is there anything on that you want to comment on, Max?
No, I'd need to think about that a bit more before I had anything significant to say, I think.
Well, you think, I mean, a greengrocer could afford to have 3 servants living in his house. So obviously there was more money available to go around back then. And also we think of the upper class having servants, and yet we don't think of being a greengrocer as being upper class. Well, following an apprenticeship and a series of appointments in the family business, which he successfully expanded, William began manufacturing Sunlight soap, building a substantial business empire with many well-known brands such as Lux and Lifebuoy. Also Vim as well. That's one of the ones that I recognise that's still around today. In 1886, together with his brother James, he established Lever Brothers, which was one of the first companies to manufacture soap from vegetable oils, and which is now a part of the Anglo-Dutch transnational business Unilever. In 1887, he built an entire village for his workers as he sought to put his views on moral capitalism into action, in a similar way to George Stephenson, the father of railways, who also believed that the profits should be shared among the workers and used to raise their standard of living. William believed that a happy and healthy worker was a good worker, and the village that he built became known as Port Sunlight, and we'll have a look at that in detail when we get there. After this, he became the victim of a media conspiracy against him, which he managed to defeat, before briefly sitting as a Liberal MP for Wirral and later as Lord Leverholm in the House of Lords as a peer. He was an advocate for the expansion of the British Empire, particularly in Africa and Asia, which supplied palm oil, which is a key ingredient in Lever's soap product, lime. And his firm has recently been smeared through association with the alleged forced labour and atrocities that supposedly took place in the Belgian Congo in 1911. And most of those accusations actually come from a book that was written by a communist just in the last 20 years. There were accusations back then of some bad things that happened, but nowhere near the accusations that are being made today. And we have a podcast on this at radioalbion.com. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson did a whole episode on the hoax, propaganda, porn that was this allegations about the Belgian Congo. And in our series that we're beginning today, we will be mainly taking a look at the paternalistic village that he built for his workers and the media conspiracy against him, and also his later life when he bought two islands in Scotland and tried to do the same there. But we will start with a look at his early life. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Just to say that approach that Lord Leverhulme had was in line with other benevolent capitalists that existed at the time. And there were, I think we've mentioned in previous episodes of Bourneville and the way in which the Cadbury family created Bourneville as a garden city. This was the time of the Garden City movement, which was started in 1898 by Ebenezer Howard, which resulted in the building of Letchworth, Welling Garden City, and Brentham Garden suburbs, all of which were garden cities. And so there is this movement at that time where there are amongst the capitalists that were active in Britain at the time, there were people who had a very benevolent attitude towards their workers and who appreciated that good work is done by people that are happy, and that it is the business of an entrepreneur to make sure that the people that work in their business are happy and fulfilled and share in the profits that are generated.
Yeah, it's a socialist, but it's also nationalist as well. I mean, today it's all unions and it's making out that the guys at the top are the bad guys, and there's class war, and the lower classes should be against the upper classes. And yet here we have an example of somebody who worked his way up to the upper class, and he did all he could for his workers, building them villages, making them look really good, and trying to do everything that he could for his people. And he tried to export that as well for the Africans in the Congo. You know, he built a village there for them. He built everything that he'd actually built in Britain for them, but they weren't interested in it. It didn't work there. And we'll get to that later on. And the word I was trying to think of that I couldn't think of was atrocity propaganda. That's what the books about the Belgian Congo are now. They are atrocity propaganda or atrocity porn. Did you want to add anything else there, Max?
Well, just that if anybody's interested, there is a village in the middle of Bedfordshire called Stewartby, and there was I think it was called the Stewartby Brick Company that existed there and in that vicinity of Bedfordshire, where there are deep supplies of clay that can be used to make bricks. There were lots of brickworks in that area. But Stewartby was, again, not exactly a garden city, but a garden village. And if you get the opportunity just of taking a short diversion off the M1 as you're travelling through Bedfordshire, you can go to Stewartby. And when you get to Stewartby, you recognise it instantly because it's like driving into Trumpton. You know, it looks like a life-sized toy village, complete with its own post office and shops and things of this sort. But every house is built to a high standard. Every house stands in its own garden, and the garden's set back from the road so that there's plenty of room for children to play, and that people have got plenty of room in their gardens so that they can cultivate their gardens and grow vegetables if they want to in their back gardens or whatever. But it's when you drive into Stewartby for the first time, you're just amazed because it's just as I say, like driving into a life-size toy village.
And when you're working at a good place with a good employer, you have a good sense of camaraderie with the team that you're working with, and you do make good friends there. And it does make sense to sort of all be living together and to look after these people. And it was actually a visit to Port Sunlight that actually prompted Michael to recommend that we actually looked into this. He's been to visit the place. It's still open there today. There are still people that live there. There's an art museum that Lever built there. There's churches there. There's all sorts of stuff there. Let's get into his early life then. William Lever was born on 19th of September 1851 in Bolton, Lancashire, England. He was the eldest son and the seventh child born to James Lever. I guess maybe Lever is the British pronunciation of that word, but I used to work for one of these companies, and I'm sure they refer to it as Unilever. So I'll refer to him as Lever. He was the seventh child born to James Lever, 1809 to 1897, a grocer, and Eliza Hesketh, a daughter of a cotton mill manager. From age 6 to age 9, William attended a small private school run not far from the Lever family home. At the age of 9, he was sent to another of Bolton's private schools before finishing his formal education at Bolton Church Institute from 1864 to 1867. Not a particularly bright scholar, he was nevertheless keen to acquire academic learning. His mother wanted him to enter the learned professions, ostensibly medicine, and William himself was very interested in becoming an architect. And we can also see that in the buildings at Port Sunlight. And no house is built the same as another. And he actually brought in dozens of different architects to actually work on it. His father, however, had other somewhat less erudite plans for his eldest son. And thus, not long after his 15th birthday, he started work in the family grocery business. In the celebrated Victorian manner, the boss's son was initially, at least, shown no preferential treatment, being required to sweep the floor and tidy up before the staff arrived. And I'll just stop there again. I mean, this reminds me of what Professor Edward Dutton has said about the schooling that the upper classes used to have, where they were treated very badly at school, so that they had some solidarity with the working classes. And I think there was this feeling back then that if you were well off, or if you were the boss, then you had to treat your son or the people beneath you. You had to get them to have some solidarity with the others so they didn't see that they were above everybody else or were abusive to anyone else. I guess this is a commendable thing.
And this used to be a principle also within the police force. If you joined the police years ago, you had to join as a police constable. And I think you had to do something like 2 years service as a police constable before you could be considered for any higher promotions. And this then ensured that even people who joined the police force from wealthy backgrounds had a 2-year grounding in what it's like to be a policeman on the beat before they were placed in a position where they would have to make decisions that would affect the lives and safety of other men and women.
I think it's a very good idea. You know, start your way at the bottom so you understand it all. Other tasks included various practical assignments, more to do with the fundamentals of the wholesale grocery trade, almost certainly designed to prepare the youth for management in later years. His remuneration was a shilling a week all found, which meant that his board and lodgings were provided, making the financial aspect of the contract more or less pocket money. Well, that's still more than they were getting 50 years earlier. 50 years earlier, they were just getting board and lodging. They didn't get that shilling a week extra. Your friends and your family had to provide that. At some stage, William was moved to the administration department, where he learned about and subsequently reorganized the firm's accounting and bookkeeping systems. Perhaps in order to escape the shackles of his father's close supervision, he eventually petitioned to take the place of a retiring sales representative. In those days, being a rep meant a great deal of traveling by horse and carriage, and spending nights away from home, as well as a measure of independence and some leeway in making decisions and brokering deals with the canny retailers on his route. And this is interesting. He must have really enjoyed this, actually, because later years, he went on a holiday by horse and carriage with a specifically built carriage, and he just spent the whole summer travelling around Dorset and Devon, around the byways, sort of pretty much living the life of a gypsy, but with servants on board as well. And before the time when people used to go away by motor car with caravan, he did it by horse and carriage.
And what you've just presented there actually answers a question that you posed to me a bit earlier on, which is about the income that a greengrocer would have. It appears that rather than just having one greengrocer shop and being a proprietor of a greengrocer shop, that Lord Leverholm's father was the proprietor of a wholesale greengrocer's business where they were that they were selling their produce on to other greengrocers. So he would have then had a large number of employees and would be making more money than the owner of a local greengrocer corner shop, for example.
And they also had more products as well. I mean, they were doing soap and all sorts of stuff, and they were manufacturing it themselves. And I think shops used to have their own concoctions, like chemists used to have their own medicines that they would get made up, and they were unique to that shop, the same as a tobacconist will have unique types of tobacco that used to be only available from that shop. And it wasn't just tobacconists and chemists. I think it was greengrocers and all the sort of shops we used to have. They used to say that the English are a nation of shopkeepers, didn't they? So
it must have been something
we used to pride ourselves on. The Lever family were Congregationalists, and James Lever, a teetotaler and a non-smoker, applied its principles in his business life as well as in his personal life. In accordance with non-conformist tenets, the Lever family held frequent Bible readings at home and were regular worshippers at the local chapel. Thus, William's circle of friends tended to compromise children of similar backgrounds and beliefs. Among these was Elizabeth Ellen Hulme, whose family also resided on Wood Street. In the tradition of the 19th century well-to-do middle classes, William paid court to Elizabeth over several years, and when the financial circumstances allowed, he formally proposed marriage, and on the 17th of April 1874, after a two-year engagement, they were married. And that's where the Hulme part of his name actually comes from. And so I guess this was almost like an arranged marriage. I guess this was the end of the sort of arranged marriage era. You sort of knew who you were going to marry when you were young, if you had rich parents, wealthy parents. In 1879, the Lever family business acquired a failing wholesale grocer in Wigan, affording young William an opportunity to prove his ability as a quasi-autonomous administrator. The expanded activity necessitated a search for new suppliers, taking William to Ireland, France, and other parts of Europe, appointing local agents to safeguard the firm's interests. At this time, his flair for advertising and branding began to emerge, as he successfully differentiated the Lever brand from generic commodities. By the end of 1879, the business's prospects were good enough to convince William and Elizabeth to invest in a new home in Bolton. And by 1881, the expanding Wigan business warranted the commissioning of new premises. Lever and Company was expanding steadily. And he was a bit of a genius with advertising. He ended up purchasing lots of paintings, really, really good paintings. And then he would stick the brand, the Sunlight Soap, which was the brand name that he would use, he would then stick that on the painting. And some of the listeners may have seen these old advertisements, really nice, nicely painted, because they're actually painted by expert artists. And he would buy the painting, and of course the painting didn't have a copyright on it, and then he would stick the advert of the company on it. There was one that actually complained about that, but it's quite indicative of the time when you actually see the adverts that he put up there. I'm sure listeners will recognise them and get nostalgic for them. I don't know if there are any comments on any of that, Max?
Well, that sounds to me as if he was using sound business sense there in making his product associated with good quality paintings that presumably would have depicted scenes or depicted objects or whatever that were consistent with the brand image that he was trying to create. And so it's an early use of sophisticated marketing techniques.
Yeah, cleanliness, purity, beauty, that sort of thing he was trying to get across, I think. In 1884, having developed Lever and Company to a point where it was virtually self-governing, William resolved to capture a large share of the international soap trade. In essence, he planned to manufacture and market a range of high-quality, price-differentiated products using a strategy based upon his experiences with butter and other commodity products. There you go, also selling butter at the grocers, not just vegetables. Thus, instead of selling soap by weight, he had it cut into small, manageable tablets which were individually wrapped. The 1875 Trademark Registration Act protected trade names from counterfeiters and imitators, and this opened the way for brand name recognition and consumer loyalty. Within 12 months, Lever had registered a series of trademarks, among them Sunlight, a house style that was later applied to a range of household soaps differentiated mainly by colour, pale, mottled and brown, with a fourth variant presented as a product that was especially formulated for washing clothes. This Sunlight self-washer soap was widely advertised using billboards and posters located at public places throughout northern England. And yeah, I think a lot of this was laundry. I mean, I guess we don't think of soap as actually being used for laundry now. We think of laundry detergent. But back yeah. then, it was all sorts of cleaning products, basically.
But the use of the term sunlight as well, it's what people, when people think about washing on a washing line, you imagine going out and it being a sunny day and the sun shining through the line of sparkling clean washing and it will having a nice fresh smell. So it sort of conjures up all those sort of evocative thoughts, doesn't it? The word sunlight.
Yeah, it's exactly what he was trying to get across, I think, there, Max.
Absolutely.
At that time, Lever had to rely for supplies on soap boilers, independent firms that specialised in producing soap to order, who were then expected to work to his proprietary formula. But the reliability of these suppliers was, however, apparently questionable, as variations in the end product gave rise to complaints about the effectiveness and even the smell of self-washer. I think in some cases, if it wasn't absolutely fresh, the outside of it would start to go rancid, which did cause a problem. But it was such good soap that there were people that refused to use anything else, and they would just scrape this rancid stuff off the top of it. And I guess he was one of the first to think of putting it all in these bars and wrapping them up separately instead of just selling it by the chunks. And you can't imagine buying soap by the pound at the greengrocer's. After much consideration, William began to consider the possibility of taking control of the manufacture and thus the quality of Sunlight soaps. He had discovered a small producer based in Warrington that badly needed to increase its output in order to become profitable, and although Lever could probably have solved its problem through placing orders for most of his soap, he clearly wanted to take complete control. Having persuaded his father and younger brother that it would be a beneficial strategy, William raised sufficient capital for the takeover to take place, and in August 1885, Lever and Company, wholesale grocers, added soap manufacturing to its range of activities. The success of the Sunlight brand, especially after Lever assumed full responsibility for the product's quality, was exceptional. So much so that by the end of 1887, it had become impossible to squeeze any more capacity from the Warrington plant. Having failed to either extend the site or find more space in the areas, Lever eventually decided to move the whole manufacturing facility to an 11-acre greenfield site near Birkenhead. Of course, this is when the possibility arises to start building a village around it. In 1887, Lever bought 56 acres of land on the Wirral in Cheshire between the River Mersey and the railway line at Bebbington, and this site became Port Sunlight, where he built his works and a model village to house its employees. Now, a model village is a type of mostly self-contained community built from the late 18th century onwards by landowners and business magnates to house their workers. Although the villages are located close to the workplace, they are generally physically separated from them and often consist of relatively high-quality housing with integrated community amenities and attractive physical environments. Model is used in the sense of an ideal to which other developments could aspire. Imagine that, your boss today building you a house, and not just any house, but the best house, because they wanted to compete amongst themselves to show who was the most looking after their workers. And it's so different from today when you have 0-hour contracts and temping companies. And back then you were expected to work for the company for life, and the company was expected to look after you and give you surroundings which would improve your health, even to give you beautiful surroundings to live in. Rather than
and that description you've just given exactly matches the description really that I gave of Stuart B in Bedfordshire, which is just like that. And although the term model is intended to be interpreted as the ideal village, it also does create a kind of an aesthetic which makes it appear as though you're entering a full-sized model or a toy village, effectively, because it's been constructed in the way that somebody would construct an ideal toy village. So the word model there has in my view two meanings as far as the term is concerned, model village.
Well, I guess they were sort of competing against one another to see who could build the best, and also trying to sort of put pressure on the government. You know, if we can build houses like this for our workers, why can you not build houses like that for everyone, for the people that aren't working for these big companies? Why not make council houses like that? As the Industrial Revolution took hold, industrialists who built factories in rural locations provided housing for workers clustered around the workplace. An early example of an industrial model village was New Lanark, built by Robert Owen. Philanthropic coal owners provided decent accommodation for miners from the early 19th century, and Earl Fitzwilliam, a paternalistic colliery owner, provided houses near his coal pits in Elsicar near Barnsley that were of a class superior in size and arrangement and inconveniences attached to those of working classes. They had 4 rooms each and a pantry, and outside a small garden and a pigsty. Quaker industrialists George Cadbury and Rowntree's built model villages by their factories. Cadbury built Bourneville between 1898 and 1905, and a second phase from 1914, and New Earswick was built in 1902 for Rowntree's. William Lever's Port Sunlight had a village green, and its houses espoused an idealised rural vernacular style. And it really does sound quite impressive, this village, when we get into it. We'll get into that next week, though. Do you want to add anything to this, Max? Any thoughts on these various examples here, these philanthropic business owners?
Well, just that you're absolutely right in terms of comparing the motivations of those patriotic capitalists during that period of time when there was when the Garden City movement was springing up, and the very quaint and idealistic and idealized proportions of the villages that they created, and what a wonderful development that was. And it did go on to inspire, you know, in the early post-war period during the 1950s, it did inspire lots of local councils to build what were actually quite generous council properties in those days, with large gardens, larger houses, with the intention of housing large families. It's just a pity, really, that then economic pressures caused governments in later decades to then build high-rise blocks and things of that sort, which have all the sort of attendant problems that we're all pretty familiar with that afflict high-rise blocks of flats. It's just a pity that the Garden City movement and the council house building programs that were spawned by that Garden City movement didn't maintain their standards into the modern time.
I find it interesting that they had a pigsty there. They obviously had enough of a garden so you could grow your own vegetables, and you had enough room there for your animals as well. So you were sort of self-contained and self-sufficient. You compare that to the so-called philanthropists today, George Soros and I've forgotten his name, Bill Gates. I mean, there are supposed philanthropists today. Where are the villages that Bill Gates has built for his Windows staff? And what has George Soros done apart from try to subvert entire countries? And the word philanthropist today, it's sort of a more associated with these NGOs that get used to subvert countries. I mean, the Clintons are seen as philanthropists. You know, the Clinton charity. We don't seem to have any great philanthropists like this anymore. And that coincides with the loss of patriotism and nationalism as well. I mean, as we heard at the beginning of this, William Leverholm was a big supporter of the British Empire. He was very conscious of his ethnicity and of his people, and he wanted to do the best for them. Okay, our greatest Briton for this week is, once again, Lord William Leverholm, or Leverholm. I was told last week that in actual fact, because I thought the word was lever, that may have just been because of the local accent where I heard it being referred to. And I have had other people tell me that it is actually Leverholm and it's Unilever. So it was just in the part of the country where I was working at the time that people were referring to it as Unilever. So I shall try to refer to it as Leverholm this week. So we'll start with a recap. Last episode, we heard how William was the son of a teetotal greengrocer, and he followed in the footsteps of his father, eventually becoming a salesman for the business before the company expanded into making its own soap. Lever were the first to produce soap in its own packets, and their brand was called Sunlight Soap. By 1887, they were needing their own factory for soap making, and in keeping with William's ideas about moral capitalism, he made sure to build a village for his employees nearby to the factory. This was not cheap accommodation for employees to simply sleep in. It was a model village, meaning it was intended to be as perfect a place to live as possible. This was quite a common thing at the time, with patriotic-minded employers doing their best to help raise their fellow countrymen to a higher standard of living. And that's where we got to last week. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Max?
Just to emphasise the fact that William Leverholm wasn't the only person doing this, that there was this Garden City movement at the time where a number of capitalists developed a form of benevolent capitalism where they felt that it was part of their duty not just to provide employment for their workforce, but also to create a healthy environment for them to live in, so that not only did the company benefit from the hard work and profits that were generated, but also so that the workers benefited from that as well.
It's something they were really proud of as well. The actual first turf that was dug with a silver shovel, and Leverholm and his wife, they went across on a special barge to the plot of land, and his wife was the first to actually use this shovel. He took a hands-on approach with this. He was involved in every part of this, and he was particularly proud of it. The model village was actually called Port Sunlight, and it is still there, and we'll take a look at it now. From 1888, Port Sunlight Village offered decent living conditions in the belief that good housing would ensure a healthy and happy workforce. The community was designed to house and support the workers. Life in Port Sunlight included intrusive rules and implied mandatory participation in activities, and the tied cottages meant that a worker losing his or her job could be almost simultaneously evicted. And of course, this comes from Wikipedia, so they're trying to make out that it was a really bad place to live. It wasn't. It was a lovely place to live, and they could decide on the rules and the laws that that they wanted. He didn't tell people that they were going to get kicked out if they misbehaved or anything like that. He didn't put people that were likely to misbehave actually in the village. It was like a reward for if you were a really good worker and you put everything you had into your job, then you would be asked if you wanted to move into this village. And by all accounts, the people that were in there were extremely happy. In some matters, Lever was keen to allow the residents of Port Sunlight a degree of democratic control. And this seems to have led to a common conviction that he was in favour of women's suffrage, a belief that possibly stems from a situation arising in connection to the Bridge Inn, a Port Sunlight temperance pub that was opened in 1900. Lever was a lifelong teetotaler, and he naturally assumed that the bridge would be, quote, dry. So I guess at the time they had a craze for pubs that didn't actually have drinking in, because they had the temperance movement, which was anti-alcohol. But within 2 years of its opening, representations were made to change its status to a licensed house. Lever promptly announced that he would not impose his own views, and that the issue would be decided by a referendum, insisting somewhat unconventionally for that time that women could take part, with the added proviso that the bridge would only become a true British pub if a supermajority of 75% was in favour. Lever probably felt confident that the outcome would support his abstemious sentiments. But in the event, more than 80% voted for an alcohol licence, and even though some people petitioned Lever, urging him to use his absolute authority in Port Sunlight and ignore the referendum, he refused to do so. Good man. I like the way that he still retains the absolute authority. So he has this democratic will, but he can also put a stop to it if necessary.
That's right. A true democrat paying for the creation of Port Sunlight and then still supporting the people that lived there, even though they made a decision that went against its principles. And this it was quite common amongst the families who tended to have this attitude of benevolent capitalism. They very often they did tend to be teetotalers, because a lot of them were Quaker families, and they disagreed with the drinking of alcohol for religious reasons. I know that Welwyn Garden City and Letchworth were created that didn't have any public houses in them whatsoever initially. Both those towns now do have public houses, but in the centre of the towns, where in any other similarly sized town there would be quite a large number of public houses, they tend to have just very, very few of them. And so I guess those public houses have greater demand, and so therefore are on a more profitable footing than other public houses might be in other places.
Well, I think they wanted people to be the best people that they could possibly be. They wanted to encourage good habits in them. They wanted them to live in beautiful surroundings and do their own gardening and keep their own animals. I mean, some of these places, each house had a pigsty, and they had ways to improve yourself there, library there, swimming pool there. There was all sorts of facilities that they built there in this village as well. So I think there was this big encouragement to be the very best person that you could possibly be. So you wouldn't really want to encourage people to get drunk, but if they wanted to have a pub there, if they wanted to have a drink, then they were welcome to have a drink. Lever himself, he used to sleep in the outdoors, and in one of the castles that he lived at, he actually removed half the walling so that it was open to the sky. And apparently he was like that for his whole life. He wanted to sleep in the open air. So he had removed the windows in the buildings that he was actually living in. He was somewhat of an eccentric, which I think is a great thing. You know, the British are well known for being eccentric, but I don't think he forced this on everybody in Port Sunlight. They had functioning windows in their houses.
And I mentioned last week about the village of Stewartby in Bedfordshire, about how it looks like a sort of a life-sized toy village. And that there's a style of building that has been employed in Stewartby, which is very characteristic of that particular village. But I've also noticed that there are lots of estates scattered around Bedfordshire that are owned by the Duke of Bedford, and where houses were built by the Duke of Bedford as tied cottages for his estate workers. And those tied cottages are constructed to the same basic style and are of a very similar size to the cottages that were provided in Stewartby, and it's well worth it if you sort of visit in that area, just having a look at going to Stewartby and having a look at the style of building and just imagining the way in which our society could have developed from that point onwards, where it could have been that social housing would have been constructed of that type, and council houses and houses for for people of limited means, etc. Social housing, that's what I was striving for. If social housing was all constructed to that sort of style, it would make a very stylish housing stock for this country, I think it would have been good had that happened.
Well, you imagine what some of the housing was like at the time, that the slums, and this was the opposite of that, and the idea of putting people one on top of the other in skyscrapers and blocks of flats, I don't think anybody would have wanted to do that back then. Everybody lived one on top of the other. You wanted to have space. You wanted to make it conducive to enjoyment of life. In reality, workers' social lives were policed from the head office, and some of Lever's employees clearly resented his paternalism. However well-intentioned, the power it afforded the company, even though it was rarely exercised, was viewed as an attack on workers' liberty and human rights. Although many such people preferred to find their own accommodation, there were others who, for whatever reason, were never given an opportunity to reside in Port Sunlight. Perhaps Lever's observations on this matter are revealing. And he said, "The private habits of an employee have really nothing to do with Lever Brothers, providing the man is a good workman. At the same time, a good workman may have a wife of objectionable habits, or he may have objectionable habits himself, which make it undesirable to have him in the Port Sunlight village." So it was only if you were, you know, if you were, had a good character and you were of high morals that you would actually be put in this village. So, you know, you would have good neighbours if you went there. So it was like a reward. And I think they tried to put it down today. Wikipedia tries to put it down, I think, saying that it's an attack on workers' liberty and human rights. I doubt very much whether they saw it as that. I think they would have seen it as what a great employer, providing us with a cheap house, a beautiful house, in far greater condition than the houses of the people that work in the other factories.
Yeah.
Viscount Leverholm personally supervised planning the village and employed nearly 30 different architects. I mean, he's put a lot of money into this. It was cheaper to build houses back then. But he's you know, trying to build the very best houses and make the best village that he can. 30 different architects. Between 1899 and 1914, 800 houses were built to house a population of 3,500. And one of the reasons why there were all these different architects, he wanted every house to look different as well. So everybody had their own unique house. The Garden Village had allotments and public buildings, including the Lady Lever Art Gallery, a cottage hospital, schools, a concert hall, open-air swimming pool, church, and a temperance hotel. Lever introduced welfare schemes and provided for the education and entertainment of his workforce, encouraging recreation and organisations which promoted art, literature, science, or music. Now, it doesn't sound to me as if this is against the workers' human rights and taking away their liberties. It sounds to me as if he's cares a lot about these people and he's trying to raise them up in the world. The aims of Lord Leverholm, as he became, were to socialise and Christianise business relations and get back to that close family brotherhood that existed in the good old days of hand labour. So, and that's something that was lost with the Industrial Revolution, wasn't it? The sense of being an artisan and producing the whole product yourself. And you pointed this out before, Max, with this sort of working on a factory line and not having much self-respect and not knowing how to sort of build the whole product in the end of it. So he's trying to get back that sense of self-worth that the workers actually had, and to get them involved in the work, and to get them feeling like they're doing a good thing. So it's not just that they're doing it for wages.
This ties in with the teachings of Robert Blatchford and the Clarion movement that we had earlier.
And what time is that? Because this is about 1900. So that was before then, wasn't it? Slightly before then.
Yes, I think it was the 1890s, and it probably was as well the early 1900s.
So that would have tied in. He would have been influenced by him then, I would have thought.
Yes, almost certainly.
He claimed that Port Sunlight was an exercise in profit sharing, but rather than share profits directly, he invested them in the village. He said it would not do you much good if you send it down your throats in the form of bottles of whiskey, bags of sweets, or fat geese at Christmas. On the other hand, if you leave the money with me, I shall use it to provide for you everything that makes life pleasant. Nice houses, comfortable homes, and healthy recreation. And again, that makes sense that rather than just having a small bit for each person to spend on, which they can't really buy very much, if he's got a large bag full of money there, he can put it to good use, buying things that are going to help everybody out. Rather than an individual having a small windfall, everybody's got a windfall there, a large windfall. If you think about it, swimming pool, concert hall, hospital, schools. The historical significance of Port Sunlight lies in its combination of model industrial housing, providing materially decent conditions for working people, with the architectural and landscape values of the garden suburb influenced by the ideas of William Morris and the arts and crafts movement. Each block of houses was designed by a different architect. The backs of any of the houses cannot be seen, and each house is unique. In terms of architectural features, there is half timbering, carved woodwork and masonry, pargetting or ornamental plasterwork, moulded and twisted chimneys, and leaded glazed patterns. Some of the houses were built in Flemish style with bricks imported from Belgium. He's really showing these people how much he thinks of them, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah. I've been in houses of this sort, as I say, throughout Bedfordshire. There are lots of houses of this sort that are on the Duke of Bedford's estate and in Stuart Bee and similar places. And I've been inside a lot of these houses, and it's exactly what you've described there. You know, there is these leaded like windows, half timbering, there's like wood paneling inside some of the houses as well, and the twisted chimneys, etc., with patterning, etc., on the outside to make the properties look really attractive. And a lot of people, you know, there's a great premium for, you know, if anybody is a tied worker or living in tied accommodation in any of these houses, and they leave and that house becomes vacant, lots of people apply to either move in as a tenant or apply to purchase the properties, and they do command a higher price than other similarly sized properties because of their attractive design.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. I mean, these houses are still there today. There's still a community there today. They've still got the art museum there. I mean, he's put all these artworks there for people to look at. He wants to get people involved in culture as well. He was also known for being a Freemason, and this is really interesting. In 1902, he became the first initiate of a Freemason's lodge that he built, bearing his name, which was built in Port Sunlight. So this is after he's actually become a very wealthy businessman, a very, very good businessman, and then he becomes a Freemason. But it's not like he's been asked to become a Freemason. He builds his own Freemason's lodge, and he's the first initiate in it, which I don't know if that's a very common thing to do. Maybe he was hoping to be asked to become a Freemason, but hadn't been. I mean, most people that are involved in business, they are Freemasons. And he sort of worked his way around it by building his own lodge and naming it after himself and then becoming a Freemason. And this is after he's already done all his business. In 1907, he became Worshipful Master, and he went on to found many lodges and hold various offices at national level. And in 1919, he was appointed Senior Grand Warden of the Grand Lodge of Master Masons of England. and he was also provincial senior grand warden of the provincial Grand Lodge of Cheshire and founded many other lodges. And I just find that incredible to not have actually started off as a Freemason and to have built your own lodge and done this and then gone on after you've already become a successful businessman to get involved with the Masons. The Masons must have liked him, basically, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, any thoughts on this, Max?
Well, yeah, I mean, it may well be that he was trying to introduce the what he would see as the benefits of Masonry to the workers that he had in that lived in Port Sunlight. Yeah, it is an unusual way of going about things, creating your own Masonic lodge. And perhaps he saw the Masonic movement and felt that it could be done better, and so initially wanted to gain a foothold in Masonry, and did this by creating his own lodge, and then used his influence to reform some of the lodges that he perhaps felt could do the job better.
I mean, it did have quite a good reputation in Britain, really, up until this time, and it was the French Freemasonry that was involved in the Bolshevik Revolution and the French Revolution. There was I forget what the difference of it. There's two different types of Freemasonry. There's one that emanates from London, and there's another one that emanates from France, and the British one had a better reputation than the French one. And there are a lot of charitable people that are involved with it. And on the surface, it is a charitable institution. Well, after that, there was a media conspiracy against him. By 1905, many of the raw materials used in the manufacture of soap were being used by makers of margarine and other new products. And in early 1906, it was clear that this increased demand was not temporary, and prices rose sharply. Concern in the soap-making industry was widespread, and in some cases acute. Competition became fierce, leading to increases in advertising expenses, which served only to exacerbate an already critical situation. Lever himself considered, and then rejected, some rather drastic alterations to the Sunlight formula, eventually deciding on reducing the weight of the standard bar. In July 1906, he was asked to attend a meeting in Liverpool called by a group of soap makers based in the north of England. The result was an accord to put in motion changes that would effectively cartelise the industry by stifling competition and controlling prices to the consumer. Lever attempted to rationalise the formation of the Soap Trust by claiming that the industry would become more efficient, thus making cost savings that could then be passed on to the consumer. Assertions that could never be realised. Financial manoeuvres made by Lever were designed to maximise the Lever brothers' position within the cartel, included takeovers and share issues, but as more people became aware of their plans, it was inevitable that information would be leaked to the press. Nevertheless, retrenchments were set in motion, including the cancellation of several substantial press advertising campaigns. By October, several newspapers were publishing articles about the Soap Trust, and some began to represent Lever as a leading character in an infamous conspiracy. Headlines in the Daily Mail, the Daily Mirror, and the Evening News proclaimed Soap Trust Arithmetic, how 15 ounces make a pound. Dismissal of employees begins, and Trust Soap Already Dearer. Other allegations included claims that the trust was trying to control the available supplies of raw materials and that it was preparing to use unsavoury substances in its soaps. Port Sunlight, parodied as Port Moonshine, was portrayed as a sweatshop. Reports by disgruntled retailers were given prominent positions and readers were urged to buy products made by non-trust manufacturers. I mean, this is quite serious. And again, you think if he was a Freemason, maybe they wouldn't have been doing this against him. They've obviously got a dislike for him somehow. And I think he probably would have actually passed the savings on to the consumer. And he probably thought this was a good idea. The campaign had a surprisingly rapid and strikingly negative impact on the member companies, particularly on Lever Brothers businesses. By November 1906, Lever sales had fallen by 60% compared with the previous year, and Lever Brothers shares had lost around 25% of their value. Other members of the combine experienced similar devastating declines. Such conditions inevitably led to a reassessment of the position, and following a meeting of all firms involved in the alliance, but without the wholehearted approval of Lever himself, a decision was made to bring the organization to an end. Most of the members of the failed cartel found their reputations seriously tarnished, and none escaped financial damage. Lever estimated his losses at considerably over $500,000. For Northcliffe, this was clearly a victory of liberty over iniquity, a view reflected in the Daily Mail's headline, "Public Opinion Smashed the Soap Trust." And I don't think it was public opinion. I think this was the newspapers ganging up on it. And it's not just me that thought that either, but go on, Max.
I suspect this would have been a move to impose laissez-faire capitalism in place of the paternalistic capitalism that Leverholm advocated. And I think that what you'll find here is that the companies that felt that they didn't have sufficient control over the products that are needed to produce soap decided that they wanted to break the cartel that had been created, and I would imagine that the cartel that had been created was done for paternalistic reasons by Leverholm, because all of his other actions have been paternalistic. So I don't have a sort of thorough understanding of the principles involved here, but I would assume that Lord Leverholm was being paternalistic and did aim to provide the greatest benefit to the common good, but that there were hard-nosed business reasons why other capitalists wouldn't have wanted there to be some restriction or some restraint on their ability to make profits.
Well, I agree entirely. I think we can see that from the amount he put into the village for his workers and all the effort that went into that. He's clearly looking at this paternalistically and thinking, well, this is going to get the best deal for the customers, for the consumers. And the media themselves, the newspapers, they didn't want that.
And considerably over $500,000 would probably be something like, in today's terms, around about £1 billion.
Yeah, an absolute fortune that he actually lost here. And I mean, they accused him of the conspiracy, but it appears to me it was the newspapers that were conspiring against him. Well, he fought back against this, and we'll hear about that next week. Thank you very much for listening, and keep an eye out for part two in our presentation on Greatest Britain, Lord Leverholm.